Starting your own private medical practice can be the most exciting and rewarding thing you'll ever do in your career, but at the same time, it can be so daunting. Where do you start and how? That's why Gentem Health put together the podcast series, Journey to Private Practice, where we document and interview entrepreneurs, clinicians, investors, and the best in the industry to bring you actionable insights as how to start, grow, and scale your private practice. With insights tailored just for you, and actionable links in the notes, this is the Journey to Private Practice. Hey, podcast listeners, this is Omar Khatib, your host of Journey to Private Practice, as well as your head of growth at Gentem Health. With another great episode, this time we have Dr. Alejandro Badia, who got on our radar because he published this fantastic book called Healthcare from the Trenches, an insider account of the complex barriers of the U.S. healthcare system from the perspective of providers and patients. What makes this unique is that the problems of healthcare are so complicated and daunting. It's very difficult to distill it down clearly in a book. And Dr. Badia did a fantastic job of doing this, but more importantly, he went out of his way to interview other providers and patients, essentially getting the data and insights to really show all the different aspects of where healthcare is broken, and more importantly, provides potential solutions to radically transform it. He also goes into his story as a surgeon. He was born in Havana, Cuba, and comes from a very interesting family background that's very inspiring in terms of how he went to medical school, went through residency, and then started his practice now. Aside from being an author, he's also an entrepreneur. He founded the surgery center at Doral, the Miami Anatomical Research Center, his own hand to shoulder center, and then most recently, OrthoNow, which is a chain of walk-in orthopedic centers. The big takeaway you need to have from him is that he is a physician that is an entrepreneur and takes an entrepreneurial spirit to taking on the complexities and issues of healthcare to make his own impact in his way. I think you're really going to enjoy this episode. And for those of you who are in private medical practice that might be struggling with your billing, with your revenue cycle, and need some help, Gentem Health is here to help. If you go to gentem.com/podcast demo, you can get a free billing and revenue cycle analysis. It's a great report. It gives you a lot of insights using data to tell you where you might be losing revenue, where your billing can be improved, and more importantly, how you can take this data and actually put it into action to make things better. So definitely go and check that out. So with that being said, let's get on to the show. Hey, podcast listeners, this is your host, Omar M. Khatib, your host of Journey to Private Practice. My guest today, somebody who I just had the pleasure of meeting through LinkedIn. I got his book, I read it, called Healthcare from the Trenches, an insider account of the complex barriers of U.S. healthcare from the providers and patients perspective. And that's Dr. Alejandro Badia. Dr. Badia, thank you so much for joining us today. How are you doing?
Fantastic, Omar. Thank you.
Wonderful. Now, look, I'm still going through certain chapters of your book. Now, your book is close to 500 pages. But the reason why I, and for those, many of the audience know that I have my own book review show. So I'm pretty good at judging a good book. This is a very, very good book. And here's the reason why. The complexities of healthcare, including the history, it's very hard to find a good book that does a good job of not, you know, covering too deep of the topic, but also not, you know, skimming over it. You do a fantastic job, and you have a very funny way of certain takes on here. One of my favorite quotes in your book actually was when you're talking about healthcare insurance companies, and you said, you know, with health insurance companies, they're supposed to pay about 80, you know, put 85% of funds into care. And you say, which sounds like a really good idea. And you put in parentheses, kind of like communism. So there's a lot of great takes in the book. I found it very easy to read. Wonderful stories. So not only do physicians and have to read this, I'm recommending this to everyone I know in the medical industry, med device reps, pharma. Everybody has to read this book because it's applicable to everyone. But before we get into that, and I know you just came from a very exciting trip in Washington, I want to know your story, which you highlight in the book. Where did you come from? Where did you, go to school? Why did you pick medicine? If you can kind of give us a quick overview of that before we sort of dive into the topic.
Sure. Well, medicine was kind of a natural for me. My mother's family has a long, rich history in medicine from Cuba. So I was actually born in Cuba. A lot of people are still always surprised to hear that. But I left at 6 months of age. This was, you know, just the number of years after Castro came into power. And at the time, we couldn't come straight to the U.S. So we went to Spain, where my father's family is still resides. My father is from Valencia, Spain. We went to Madrid and spent 6 months there, literally standing in soup kitchen lines, you know, with immigrants. Pretty amazing story. And then it was more my father, actually, who had really the American dream, even though my mother was fully bilingual. She was teaching at a bilingual school in Havana. And we settled in New Jersey. I went public school kid all the way throughout. But from an early, early age, which I talk about in the book, so many experiences, it was pretty clear I was going to do medicine and for some reason, a surgical specialty. It was just for some reason. Was fortunate enough to get into Cornell, which really opened doors for me. You know, just a great Ivy League education. And then I went to medical school at NYU, which was ideal for me because its most important clinical affiliate is Bellevue Hospital. Now the
classic.
Classic hospital. I referenced the book and I wrote a review for the book. I was really proud to do that for the book written by William A. Nolan, M.D. The book is entitled The Making of a Surgeon. And I read that the first time, I think I was 10 or 11 years old. And I read it again when I was 16, just before I was applying to programs. So I read the book twice. In fact, I want to read it again, come to think of it. I love to read. And that book was very inspiring to me. And the irony was I ended up training at the same hospital that he trained at. And he talks about his surgical residency at Bellevue Hospital. So it's just been amazing. And I wanted to go somewhere where I would use my Spanish. So I did a fellowship in Pittsburgh, then in Germany. But I really wanted to come to Miami for a long time now. I have some more distant relatives here. And I had done some research here during a summer. And I co-founded what became a very prestigious group called the Miami Hand Center. And we were together about 13, 14 years. I allude to a lot of the reasons in the book as to why physician groups break up, kind of like marriages. And so we broke up about same amount of time ago. I've been in my own practice now for the same time, about 13 years. And that's called Badia Hand to Shoulder Center. And I've been in that. And then soon after moving, I realized that most of my patients who come to me were getting to me in a very cumbersome way, extremely inefficient. And sometimes to their ill effect for their hand problem or their elbow problem. So I started Ortho Now, which is a network of orthopedic walk-in centers. And that's where I'm at now. I'm actually, you know, still looking for the right strategic partner to really grow this at a national level. And that's where I'm at.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic. And, you know, you made me very happy because you're the first person, and I can't believe I'm saying, you're the very first person who said that they've read The Making of a Surgeon by Will Nolan, because that book was handed down to me from my father. And I'll have to show it to you because it's very old. But there's a second book he has that I also have. I'm forgetting the name of it. Huh. Right? I didn't think so either until I found it in my father's library. But it's a very little book. It looks like a novel. So as soon as we finish the interview, I'll grab it and show it to you. But right, that's fantastic. And what I love is you have a very I don't want to say a classic story, but a story that most medical schools, they want to hear, which is you have a student goes and to very prestigious schools, prestigious trainings, and then goes back to serve their community, right? And it sounds like that's exactly what you did in Miami. Now, let's talk about the book. Why did the world need this book? Why'd you write it?
Well, if you listen to all the dialogues about healthcare reform and the healthcare issues, which we clearly have in this country, despite still, I still feel we have the best healthcare in the world in terms of the advances in the technology. It's just that it's become controlled by a third party. And that third party, you know, understandably is focused on making money like any other business. But the problem is that our interests are not aligned. And when we complain about the cost of healthcare, it doesn't seem like patients really understand that a lot of this money is being siphoned out of the system largely by the insurance industry. And frankly, even by big healthcare systems, big hospitals, we've gotten to the point, and we've seen this during a pandemic. And I wrote an article that was covered in the national media about how COVID is finally laying bare the fact that you don't need to go to a hospital emergency room if you sprain your ankle, or even if you break your wrist or you have severe back pain. That is not an efficient use of that. You go to a hospital when you have head trauma, when you break your femur, when grandma breaks her hip because she's going to need to be in a hospital bed. But we've been conditioned to think that we need to do this. And of course, the insurance companies have these relationships with the big healthcare systems. And when people, little people like myself, come up with a more cost-effective solution, we can't even get the traction. So we complain about healthcare costs, but there are all kinds of interesting things that my colleagues are doing and innovators are doing in healthcare delivery, and yet you don't hear about them. So I felt I'm in the trenches of healthcare, right? I see patients, I do surgery, and I wanted to tell the story, and not just myself. I want to remind the viewers that my book has 26 contributors. So I would say I wrote 85 to 90% of it, but in many chapters, particularly in section 2 and 3, there are anecdotes from other physicians, mostly surgeons, but from a nurse, a physical therapist, an occupational therapist, a pharmacist, and some patients tell their story. So because I want this to be a book for the public to understand what our challenges are. The book is not touted to be a solution to our healthcare system, although the last chapter does provide some constructive ideas as to what we can do differently by many of the contributors, and then I comment on their suggestions. But the book is really intended to lay out what the problems are, because if you don't know what the issues are, how can you fix it?
No, absolutely. Now, some of our audience, they're not physicians. They come from the healthcare industry, and we all kind of know more or less exactly what you're speaking about. You lay out or you reference a very interesting analogy, and I hope if you can maybe kind of summarize it, because I think it's a great one for people to anchor to when they're thinking about how screwed up the system is. And that's the analogy of if healthcare or going to the doctor is like going to your favorite restaurant. Can you kind of walk us through that, and provide some color commentary? Because I've been dying to hear you talk about this.
Yeah, this was something I read a number of years ago, and it stayed with me. It turns out I had to find it, actually, because I had forgotten where I read it. And it was written by a primary care physician, a woman in Colorado. She's referenced in the book. And basically says that if restaurants were run like healthcare, the efficiency would go down greatly and the cost would go up. And it's something to the effect of that you order something and you have to get approval for it. And if I say, well, if you want salt and pepper with that, that is going to we need to inquire about that. And there's this whole process. And it ends up that the restaurant owner, basically can't stay in business because he's wasting all these resources in jumping through hoops to be able to simply deliver somebody a good meal. And that's what happens in practice. There was some of this when I went into practice 25 years ago. So I've been in the trenches for a quarter century. But certainly the days of Marcus Welby and Ben Casey and people maybe some of us grew up with watching on TV. I mean, they didn't have to go through this. And I talk a little bit about the origins of insurance, but it's gotten to the point where my concept, and I think most people's concept of insurance, should be you pay them premiums, and when something happens, they pay out. And to me, it's a great business. I mean, when you think about it, nobody in that field really needs to know that much about it. It's just they're just really making money, and that's fine. There's a lot of businesses like that.
They're just holding on to money,
yeah,
right?
Just, yeah, you know, yeah. It's like a bank. They just take money from here and then transfer it here. It's not like a carpenter who actually makes a chair, right? There is something that's right. So, but that's fine. That's the way society works. interesting that those are the people really with the money in our society, right? The big shiny buildings, they're not clinics. They're banks and they're insurance companies, and fine. But somewhere along the way, we allowed the insurance companies to actually dictate, in many cases, how the healthcare is provided. And no question, we need oversight. And I mentioned that in a book. So I have no problem with an insurance company, you know, making sure that somebody isn't overutilizing, but they spend way too much money creating these hurdles with people who really don't have the knowledge or education to make decisions. And so they just rubber stamp things, but that person is getting a salary and benefits. So that's taking money away from the nurse or the physical therapist or the physician who depends on that to pay their overhead. So to me, you know, I think this whole concept of authorization is really perverse. I mean, sometimes I'll be in my clinic, I'll go, oh my God, you know, I have somebody with a grade 4 scapholunate ligament tear. I've got to manage his carpal instability. I do it usually all arthroscopically. What concept does even my primary care doctor have about that? Let alone an adjuster sitting insurance company. I mean, once they've authorized me to see that patient, the rest should be off the table. I shouldn't have to climb and jump over hurdles to get care because those hurdles cost money. There are days in clinic where, you know, myself and colleagues just get almost enraged. Like, you know, honestly, how dare you authorize me? It's like me making, you know, when I call my IT guy, I don't know anything about that. I have to trust them to fix the problem in my computer system. What profession is there more years of training, you know, other than maybe astrophysics, right? You know, to be a subspecialty surgeon is years. Why are they second guessing us? And, ironically, I'm watching Dr. Death now. So, man, I don't know if you've seen the show yet. It's actually
rare. I haven't. I got to check it out.
It's very disturbing to me because, you know, I researched it for my book and I talk about one of the reasons that, yes, we do need, obviously, oversight in healthcare delivery. And we even need malpractice. I mean, there needs to be attorneys who can bring suits against people like this because there are some bad apples. This guy was an extreme, those things are, I think, are pretty, you know, rare. For the most part, I think most clinicians strive to do a good job, and at least in this country and many other countries, I think most of us do.
Would you say, I mean, if there is one part of the healthcare, let's say you have one wish, if there's one thing that you would eliminate completely, let's just say it's taken care of somehow, would you say it's the prior authorization?
Yes, I would say that would save an incredible amount of money. I would just make sure that, again, we would have oversight. So, you know, kind of, to me, it's kind of almost as ridiculous as with TSA, the amount of money we spent because these 19 guys decided to fly a building into a plane. And now, you know, they run grandma through the metal detector. And, you know, now we're finally relaxing, right? There's a pre-screening. Yeah. But, you know, remember the first couple of years after 9/11, it was absurd.
Oh, it was insane. It was insane.
It was absurd. Yeah, and think about the money that costs. It's same in healthcare. We don't need this kind of level of screening because it costs money.
Yeah. And I think you brought up a very interesting point, which is once you're authorized to see the patient, everything else should be off the table. It's done. It should be in your care. And I think I spoke to one physician off the record and this guy was enraged because specifically I called him the day that this happened. And he's like, you know, I have to talk to, and he was using a lot of colorful language too, but he was like, you know, I have to talk, you know, to these adjusters and people who are supposed to authorize me. Right. And they're like, oh, you're going to speak to a peer. And I'm like, how's this guy a peer? This person I'm speaking to is a physician. They're not in my specialty. So how in any way is this person even a peer, and how they even, you know, did they have any chance to even speak to me peer to peer? They have no idea what they're talking about. And I completely agree. I remember my dad even coming home from surgery a long time ago when I was in high school, and he was pissed off about this. And I was trying to understand. He's like, look, let me explain this to you. I know how to build a house. Okay. I need to get money to build that house. I'm building a house, but some idiot who knows nothing about building houses is trying to tell me what door I should use. Right. And I keep telling them, you can't use this door, it's this door. But they insist on using this door.
right? That just sounds terrible. Yeah. That sounds terrible. And then again, I mean, that's just to deliver the care. Let's just add to that when you're going to get paid and how much, right? I was very well aware of this throughout my career, but until I started working at Gentium, like I didn't realize how ridiculous it is that this is the only business in the world where you don't know when you're going to get paid or how much. And if you end up getting paid a little bit more than you should, you get penalized for that. Talk to us a little bit more about that and your thoughts on the whole reimbursement and billing process.
Well, every once in a while they overpay something. And we're talking by, it just happened to me the other day. I had to send $168 back to an insurance company. And I said to my office manager, this is really amazing because I can tell you about thousands that they haven't paid for prior procedures, the same insurance company, because they simply didn't approve a code. But in the end, you got to do what the patient needs. So we end up just sucking it up. And that's the problem is that what really angers me, I mean, in a vitriolic sense, is that they are preying upon our altruism. They know that most physicians, nurses, therapists want to do the right thing for the patients, but we're going to end up doing it somehow anyway. So they actually prey upon that. And I have a deep resentment for that. And I hope that there is a growing angst amongst physicians about this. The problem is they're coming out of medical school, and because it's so hard to go into private practice, that most of them, 85% of them now are hired. I'm actually looking for an associate now. And I remember, I mean, you know, this young lady wanted like a salary. I said, no, wait, I'm going to help you with the overhead, all the infrastructure is there. You see more patients, you do that, then that will, your income will depend on that. But no, now they're just being hired. And of course, when you're hired and it's not your business, you're looking at the clock. You're like, okay, it's 5 o'clock. I'm going to slow down now. I don't really think that's good for healthcare. I think that now again, this gets into the argument of Medicare for all, right? That's a whole nother. But I, me coming from a communist country and seeing what happened with my ex-wife's country,
yeah. How do you feel about
Venezuela? I know what a failure that is. I think people need incentive, and if you're going to ask people to put aside their entire 20s and sometimes early 30s of their life for education and for training, and then you're not going to give them the opportunity to make the income that they can for a unique skill. And I think I would say that healthcare is pretty important, relative to, hedge funds or a lot of other things where people make.
I'm right there with you.
Or playing baseball, right? I talk about that in my book. I mean, God bless these great athletes, but I think most of them would be very happy making a couple $100,000 a year to play a sport. They don't have to have contracts of $30 million a year, right? So it's funny. Our society doesn't seem to get upset about that, but when physicians make a good living, all of a sudden that's a taboo.
And it makes no sense. And I talked to certain people about this. If there's one group of people, I'm totally okay making a lot of money. Actually, there's two groups: teachers and people in healthcare.
Absolutely, teachers.
But if you look at healthcare, from physicians, to nurses and PAs, it's a hard job because not only are you working a lot of hours, it's physically exhausting and emotionally exhausting. Like I cannot imagine what it's like working in, let's say, pediatric oncology. Oh. I did research at MD Anderson. Like this is hard. It's not just, even if you're there, let's say a 9 to 5, emotionally, what you deal with, this is something else, and so I'm perfectly okay with physicians, and nurses. Like, they should be making better money, but you're absolutely right. And what makes me sad,
because the money is being siphoned off by all these intermediaries that don't really add a lot to the system. They
don't add anything to the system. And I agree with you. I think, you're absolutely right that there should be a little bit of oversight. I totally agree, because there are bad actors.
Right.
But for the most part, and you're the first person I heard say this, and you're absolutely right, is that they prey on the altruism of healthcare professionals, because healthcare professionals, even my dad in practice, there are times where he said, he's like, there's going to be a few times a year where I'm going to do a procedure and I'll do it nearly for free because the patient can't afford it. But that's like my way of trying to help the community. Right. But I think that this has gone into overdrive with healthcare insurance companies, which they're just putting you in a smaller and smaller box, and physicians and nurses and the system's just trying to find a way to make it work.
Well, I'm very fortunate in talking a little more about my story. One of the interesting things of coming to Miami, I realized it very early, is Miami's kind of the capital of Latin America. Okay. This is not really the U.S. in its classic term. I mean, the main language here really is Spanish. So I spent half my day speaking Spanish. But what I soon realized is that, you know, we have snowbirds coming down from Canada. We have all kinds of trade with the Caribbean, because these are small countries where they're not going to have, like you said, many of these countries don't have a pediatric oncologist, right? So now, yes, they can go to, as you said, MD Anderson or Sloan Kettering, but Miami is a lot closer and culturally understands these people a lot more, particularly with the language. You know, I interviewed in Houston. I was just looking around when I did my fellowship, and, you know, I realized very quickly that the people around me, most didn't speak Spanish, even though there's a growing Latin population, mostly Mexican and Central American. But my colleagues or the nursing, you know, a lot of them didn't speak Spanish. So I realized that it would be an interesting niche in Miami. But now I've developed a very international practice. And I have to tell you that it's frustrating that I end up treating some of the more affluent people in really what some very third world countries, but people who can afford to come for this treatment. And yet I'll have people who will pull in, you know, with the latest BMW and don't want to pay a copay. And that's fine with me. Yeah. I've gotten to the point in my career. Well, okay. I mean, if you know, the public also thinks that all physicians are the same, right? They don't realize that just like attorneys or plumbers, there are, you know, some are better than others, whether they have better training, whether they're more dedicated, whether they spend their weekends reading, other techniques or going to more scientific meetings. There are some that, you know, maybe are better in a particular area. But the public, I think, treats us all in one bucket. And you know what? That's okay, because the great thing is that being in Miami, I end up seeing a lot of people fly in. I would say about 30% of my surgical procedures are people who fly in.
Interesting.
Big countries are, it varies, but for some reason lately, Ecuador and Barbados are kind of the bigger countries. Huh. There are times when it's Mexico, Peru's always been big, Bolivia, believe it or not. Now, it might not be as Brazil as much. Why? Brazil actually has very, very good hand surgery. I mean, extreme. So when I go to meetings there, I love it because I actually learn a lot from them as well.
Interesting.
But this is what happens with the U.S. insurance market is that fortunately, I'm lucky being in Miami, but I end up seeing a lot of people from other countries. And that is for my practice, that is much better, which is really an irony, I think.
That is interesting. Now, I want to pivot real quick. I want to, you know, there's a couple things I do want to make sure to cover. But, you know, you just had a trip to Washington and you had met somebody there. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
That was amazing. I was put in touch with Senator Cassidy through somebody who works in sort of the healthcare business side.
And this is Bill Cassidy. Which senator? What state is he senator
of? Sorry. So Senator Bill Cassidy is a gastroenterologist from Louisiana, from Baton Rouge, I believe, and he trained in New Orleans, and went into state as a state representative and moved up, and he's now a U.S. senator. He's in his second term as a U.S. senator. He's a Republican, a moderate Republican. He got fairly well known because he was one of the Republicans who kind of bucked against Trump on certain things. But he's very, obviously very interested in healthcare issues, being a practitioner, and his wife is a surgeon. And he actually read my book, and I wanted to take my children for a summer vacation somewhere kind of educational. So I decided to go to Washington, take them to the museums and get to know our nation's history, go to the monuments. And I had been communicating with him, also sometimes speaking on phone. And then I told his team that I was coming to Washington, and they arranged for me and my children to have breakfast with him in the Capitol. And we had a very good conversation. He had to leave after an hour because they're discussing this infrastructure bill, which we all know that they're debating. But I then had a private tour of the Capitol. But, you know, I have some hopes. I think right now during the current administration, it may be challenging to make any major changes in healthcare delivery. But there's no question that it's in our radar, and we can't focus on, you know, insuring the uninsured. And I mean that is not changing healthcare delivery. We have to change how that care is delivered, and that will save so much money that we'll have a ton of money left over as a safety net for the less fortunate in our society, because everybody deserves to have adequate healthcare. There's no question about that.
Interesting. That's the first time that I heard that. So your thing is that rather than focusing on insuring the uninsured, if we focus on how we deliver healthcare to those who are insured and manage the money there, you will end up with a surplus that will take care of the uninsured. Is that correct? Did I state that correctly?
That is correct. And we do treat the uninsured, right? I said I trained at Bellevue. You've read the book, The Making of a Surgeon. I mean, half the people that went to Bellevue had zero insurance or lived on the streets, unfortunately. And we cared for them. And there are, you know, there are public funds for that need. In Miami, it's at Jackson Memorial. Although you can go to any emergency room anywhere with an acute enough problem, you might get some ugly bills later, but you'll get the care if you really need it acutely at that time. So we do. Our society does provide for that. It's not like my European colleagues who think that, you know, American patients are left lying in the street to die. I mean,
yeah. I hate when I'm sorry. I rail against Europe all the time. I hate when Europeans say that, oh, you let your people die in the streets. Yeah. I'm like, there's nobody dying in the
streets. No, exactly. But we do have our issues, right? So we do have our
issues. I agree with you that we have the best healthcare system if you have money. You know, like, so, yeah. But, you know, but it's something that has to change, you know? So what about, you know, and I were kind of jumping around and talking, but there's so many interesting things I want to cover. You know, what I like about your story is that aside from being very active in the community, trying to find ways to change healthcare, you're in private practice, you know, so you are entrepreneurial. You have a lot going on as it is. What inspired you to start Ortho Now? What's the Ortho Now story? Because to be frank, you know, I found out about your book later on. The way I first found you is reading about Ortho Now, which I think has a fascinating story. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, the Ortho Now was really born out of frustration. I mentioned early on that when I went into
practice, like most businesses, right?
Yeah, filling a niche, right? And I realized that. So I'm a hand surgeon, to remind the listeners. So I do from the fingertip to the shoulder. So I'm an upper extremity surgeon, and you know, we're kind of at the end of the food chain, right? I mean, most people have come to me, maybe have been to their primary care doctor and said they have shoulder pain. But what I realized is that many times all those steps, there was a lot of wasted time and money and resources, even from the insurance companies who are reimbursing for something that there's not going to be an outcome because a person doesn't know. It's like I'm a physician, and I was even an ER doctor, which I talk about in a book. To make ends meet, I did some ER shifts in Manhattan. But you know, if I had a patient with an eye problem, I mean, I don't know anything about the eye, okay? And yet I'm a physician. And the reality is that when patients go with, you know, say occult wrist pain that they've had for 6 months, that's a really complex thing. And even my colleagues in orthopedics who do other areas, the wrist is like off limits. I mean, the wrist is very complicated. So I realized that there needed to be a faster, more efficient way to get to somebody, to a subspecialist like myself. And, you know, going to the general urgent care center, you know, they're usually, you know, family practice doctors or something who are working shifts in these urgent cares. They're just not going to know a lot of orthopedics. It's not their fault. They don't have the training. But yet the public thinks they can go to these places with an injury and that they're going to get treated. And they're going to get treated, most appropriately. And it's just not the case. And I decided to first I delved into a general urgent care, because orthopedic urgent care was just sort of on the horizon. This is about 12 years ago. And I opened something called, it was a franchise called Doctors Now. They're based in the Midwest, very good general urgent care. But I realized that the patient, the musculoskeletal patients weren't really coming to us because it's not marketed to that, right? It's doctors now. So I decided to close it, lost a lot of money, but I learned a lot. And it was a franchise. So I opened Ortho Now, and then I learned so much about franchising, being a franchisee, that I opened it and we decided to franchise it. But that was a big mistake. Franchising in healthcare, way too many. You know, you have the healthcare lawyers talking to the franchise lawyers. The regulations are so onerous, and you really can't police the franchisees. You know, it's not like you're flipping a hamburger.
It's a lot of work.
You know, you can't. It's not like a yogurt or a gym franchise. I mean, this is pretty complex. You know, musculoskeletal care at all levels. So we a few
and accepting ago, insurance, not cash based, right?
No, we take. In fact, we you know, one of our first insurances was Medicaid. We want to be able to take care of anybody in the community, and if we're not on their insurance plan, which we'd like to be, by the way, the worst thing a patient can say to us is, "Oh, you don't take my insurance." No, why for a change? Why are you not upset with your insurance company? Every week we reach out to certain insurance companies and we say, We'd like to be on your network because we don't want patients to be turned away. So we don't turn them away. We say, you know, if you want to put it on your, you know, your visa, if you think it's as important as a nice dinner to have your wrist pain evaluated, that's your choice. Most patients won't choose to do that. We've been conditioned. And the irony is if they go somewhere else, they're not even going to spend time. They may not see the right type of clinician. And they're going to pay a copay anyway, maybe a $50 or $100.
Exactly.
So why not just spend, you know, $200, see us, and then get, and then if you need something surgical, then, you know, and then we can help them find an, you know, an in-network surgeon if they need, in, you know, an ACL, a ligament reconstruction for their knee. We can find them really the best person. So we liaison with the subspecialists, but it's a way with zero, you know, hassle. In fact, most of the patients nowadays are finally using our app, which is so the app.
Nice.
So if the patient wants this, they simply click on my way now. And then it tells them which it brings up a map and you can it tells you which there's the clinics. And then it tells you which is the closest one. And then you can tell.
Oh, nice!
You can tell them I'm on my way now with my 8-year-old who, you know, hurt himself in soccer. You can send a picture of the ankle swollen, and you can call Uber and now Lyft all within the app.
I love that. I love that. And you know what's frustrating? Yep. Here you are. You're not a big conglomeration.
No,
you're a surgeon, and you created this. Meanwhile. Yep. So my insurance used to be with Kaiser. I thought Kaiser was a great system. I did everything that I was. Now I switch because I'm at a new company. So I'm with, and you know, I don't care how much I'm with United Healthcare, right? And it is such a pain. Yeah. Like, look, I went to medical school. I'm well educated. It is such a pain for me just to change my doctors. And, you know, like, you know, actually I was supposed to see a physician today, right? And then I get a message like through some random messaging system saying, oh, you've been booked for August 27th. And I replied back to them. I'm like, I booked it for today. And they're like, well, the appointment you request is no longer available. I'm like, I selected it on a freaking calendar. What the hell are you talking about?
Like
how difficult is this to do? Yeah, exactly. Oh my God. Yeah. So these things are so frustrating. And I think that, you know, people are getting fed up. And I think that more people who start educating each other, like, for example, there are certain things about medications, about going to the doctor that I learned from friends. And I'm like, I'm just going to do that now. So there are times where I just pay cash where I'm just like, I would, because the way I think, again, I'm in the startup world. I might spend maybe an extra $100, but I'll get my $100 back in the future. I'm not going to get my time back with all the BS that I have to deal with. And so hopefully I think patients are starting to get fed up and they're starting to realize like, yeah, we're going to pay a little bit more, but you know what? Much better to deal with this now. And not waste the time or energy or money dealing with this way.
Time is money.
You know?
Time is money.
Time is money.
And but I can tell you that most patients, when they show up at an Ortho Now, which is super convenient. I challenge all of the listeners. Go to our Facebook page. Type in Ortho Now. I think we have 4.6.
I'll leave it in the show notes.
4.6 or 4.7 stars. I mean, what healthcare delivery vehicle has, you know, over 4.5 stars? Why? Because we really focus on customer service. The irony is a lot of people And in fact, the only people really who leave, for the most part, not all, but for the most part, the people who leave a low star, and it's not three, they'll leave like one star. So it goes from five to
right,
one.
Yeah.
And they'll leave one. And are people sometimes who are angry because we don't work with their insurance? And what they don't realize is we would like to. We would.
Yeah.
We can't have the dialogue with the insurance company to even do that, even though it benefits them. Benefits.
Yeah. Them. And you know, and by the way, just because I'm checking, so I'm looking at it right now. So 3,000 over 3,000 followers, which is really impressive for a healthcare page.
For small, yeah.
4.4. Yeah, we have 149 reviews. That's a lot of reviews for Facebook. 4.6. That's a really high rating.
Yeah.
That's very, very hard to achieve. Because to your point, people are leaving four or five stars, or they're leaving one. Right. It's very rare somebody leaves a two or three.
Right, exactly. You know? Exactly.
And I'm just reading through all these things, like great experience, you know, amazing, really helped my daughter a lot. You know, so these are fantastic things. And yet here you are, you have to struggle dealing with an insurance company to explain why you should be in their network, right?
Well, the thing that what I've learned about healthcare is really what matters is how big you are. In other words, how big? So it's not.
That's yeah, and that's why I guess physicians are getting into groups, right? Because they're like, hey, let's get like I don't know how they do it. God bless them. But when I see like a group of like there's one my friend is a part of. It's like 50 urologists. I'm like, there are 50 surgeons in this group. I was like, that's really impressive. Because to get a group of surgeons, to get two surgeons to agree on anything, it's an act of God.
Yeah, chapter four of my book, right? Chapter four is entitled. Cats, colleagues, and collaboration, because it's like herding cats. And look, speaking of Kaiser Permanente, I'm finishing a book now called Uncaring. And, Dr. Pearl wrote a book where he talks about the physician culture, which is harmful to us physicians and to patients. And he makes a lot of very good points.
What's the name of that book? Do you know?
What's that?
The name of Dr. Pearl's book, do you know the name
yes,
of it?
Yes, Uncaring.
Oh, Uncaring. Oh, you're working on that with him.
No, I'm reading it myself. I read.
Oh, you're reading. Oh, okay, got it,
I continue to educate myself about what the problems are in our healthcare system. But I'm a big reader. I mean, I just finished a book about the Lincoln assassination, which I didn't know a lot of facts about. So I love to read.
Interesting.
But there's no question I read a lot about healthcare. I'm reading less scientific journals now, but more about the actual delivery of care and trying to figure this out. But I was mentioning that the problem is that we're small. So yes, we have 4.6 stars. We have an app, but because we're not big, the bigger companies, entities don't really notice us, and it's really unfortunate it's not about the quality and the value in healthcare, even though we talk about value-based care, and this is the big catchphrase.
It's just nice words that are thrown around.
It's just a term.
It's nice words.
You know, United Healthcare has 250,000 employees. Okay, in this country, think about that. So who's
and they made a lot of money. They made a lot of money last year too, because those premiums weren't people didn't use their health insurance. They made a lot of money last year.
Yeah. It's kind of strange. Well, one of the things I don't know, Omar, should I give this away? One of the basic tenets that I talk about in my book about lowering healthcare costs.
Yeah, you kind of beat me to it. I was like, let's give a few teasers out. But yeah, please.
Right. So I strongly believe that health insurance companies should be non for profit. I think it's great that if they are successful, just like in Germany, that was a good model. I read The Healing of America. It's a book by T.R. Reid. He's a New York Times correspondent who went to 8 or 9 countries for his shoulder pain, ironically. So I could really relate. And he had different opinions and saw how different healthcare systems work. But one great thing in Germany is that there is competition. So there is private insurance companies, but they pour their profits back into better delivery of care. But the people who work for those insurance companies can make a very good living, because I think there's nothing wrong with that. I think if you are good, so I have no problem with an insurance executive making a lot of money, but I do have a problem with an insurance company answering to Wall Street or to investors that you shouldn't be investing. I think it's okay to invest in healthcare, but to invest in healthcare insurance that's going to make money. In the end, let's face it, you know, I kind of tear into Geico, right? It's my car insurance. And I think about all the money they spend on advertising the most inane commercials that you see on TV, and they're constant. I'm not even a big TV watcher. And I think, you know, it's funny because when I had one of the few times I had a minor claim with Geico, what a chore to get paid. I'm thinking that's a fraction of what you paid for that commercial I just saw.
You know, I was down in SoCal on the beach.
Oh, the plane.
And they were plane.
They have it here,
yeah.
By the beach. So Geico.
Do you have that too?
Geico, stop spending money on planes. We all know you exist, and simply pay out your claims when somebody really needs it. How's that?
Isn't it kind of funny that it used to be owned? It used to be government owned.
I know.
You know, so it kind of makes sense that they're really, really bad at managing money.
I don't know how. I don't know how. Sorry, I have a clinician call. I'm just letting them know.
No sweat.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that just simply don't make sense. The problem is the public going to, you know, what's it going to take? You know, we saw a big change with some unfortunate, you know, incidents with police officers. We saw a big revolution. And, you know, I don't think that patients should be, you know, torching cars and trashing businesses or breaking windows. But we need to get a little more, you know, upset about this. Because otherwise, yeah, it's not going to change.
No, I completely agree. Well, you know, I want to be very mindful of your time. But to kind of wrap up, you know, we do a little bit of a rapid fire question. So I'm going to ask you three questions. You can take as long as you want to answer them or as short as you want.
Okay.
Right. But definitely, I mean, we covered a lot of fantastic topics. I'm just letting you know right now, I'm very good at spotting repeat guests. I'm pretty sure you're going to be back on.
Thank you.
So first rapid fire question I have for you, and this is a great one because, you know, from one reader to another, you know, medicine is all about continuing education, right? And so we're always getting exposed to new books and everything. Lately, or over your life, is there a book that you feel that you recommend or gift most often? And what's that book?
Wow.
That's a tough one, right?
Yeah.
And if you don't have one, what's a book that you know lately you've been recommending to people?
Well, I like to be informed, so I just like facts. I was never a big fiction reader. I'm wondering.
Same here. Yeah, same here.
I just like to learn. So, and I think that real life is often as stranger than something that somebody can come up with. So I remember I gave this book to my kids. I love this book called The People's Almanac when I was growing up. It's about this big, and it's all kinds of interesting facts and little stories about things. You know, there's a chapter, Footnote People in History, and it, you know, Caspar Hauser was this guy in Austria that nobody knows where he came from, and it's just fascinating. And I think that the more informed you are about things, the more you can bring that to your own profession or job, whatever it is. So that's a book that always comes to mind for me. The People's Almanac.
I'm getting that right now. Oh, and there's a People's. Oh, there's a second.
Yes, yeah,
so
there's
too.
A two. I have both. And then they wrote because one.
Oh, there's a third one.
There's a Book of Lists.
Interesting.
The Book of Lists.
I'm gonna get this.
Fascinating lists. famous people
gonna,
who died.
Have kids.
Famous people died having sex. It's you know, one is a pope. I'll just one is a pope.
Really?
Yeah. So okay.
Why am I not surprised? I'm gonna definitely get that. All right. So second. Okay. So great recommendation. That's I haven't heard of that one. So I'm definitely gonna get that because we're gonna be having kids soon in my family. All right. Second question is, you know, medicine is full of mentorship, right? So we've had mentors. Both clinicians, we've had business mentors, etc. You know, some of us have been lucky enough to have our own parents as mentors. So in your life, what is something a mentor has told you that was extremely painful but changed you for the better?
Ooh, painful. I can't think about it. I mean, I give some anecdotes, you know, in that first section of my book about, it's kind of autobiographical, so people can kind of understand and empathize a little bit with what our training. But I was a swimmer, so I'm excited about the Olympics. And every 4 years, I see swimming, and I was a swimmer. And my swim coach was very influential to me, and you know, he would say, you know, he would say, don't worry about the riffraff. He would say it like that, the riffraff. What he was basically saying is kind of, don't pay any attention to the people who are just going to sort of float through life. And so, you know, get in here and, you know, do your laps, do your practice, and, you know, you'll get something out of it. You know, what the work you put in, you'll get out. And it's the same, whether it be athletics or your relationships, or your profession, it's that way. And he was very influential to me. But I can't say anything, you know, painful that I have recollection. But certainly, you know, learning to focus on
that was things that definitely memorable.
And then my mentor is a hand surgeon, John Brigley in Pittsburgh, who I mentioned quite a bit. I mean, he was great because hand surgeons are known for being very, sometimes overly meticulous. They call us hand weenies, amongst other orthopedic specialties, because, you know, we're all focused on an incision about this big, where there's so many vital structures. So we have to be kind of a little bit anal retentive. But one thing I learned from him is don't get too caught up in the nonsense details. So I've learned that in surgery, I tend to be very efficient because I don't dilly dally. And I learned that from him.
Got it. Fantastic. All right. Last question for you. So I know these are rapid fire, but as you can tell, they're pretty deep questions. But the last one for you is, I want you to imagine that for the next year, a billboard is taken out throughout the country. Every physician, healthcare worker, they're going to see this. Let's say even insurance company. Everyone's going to see this billboard, right?
Okay.
What message do you put on that billboard? It could be for everyone. It could be specific to physicians, to patients. What message do you put on the billboard?
See the right clinician at the right time. Now, I say clinician because we've gotten into this using this term provider. It's funny because Dr. Pearl talks about it in Uncaring, and it was like a love song. He was singing to me. He was saying about how much doctors don't like that term, and it's because it's really kind of
it's a weird term.
It's an inclusive term. It's really an insurance term, which is fine. I mean, you have to pay a claim, you know, what provider, whether it be a therapist or a nurse practitioner or a physician. Yes, we all provide care, but we hate that term. But, you know, I don't want to necessarily say doctor because it doesn't always have to be a doctor, right? I have a lot of respect for our physician assistants and our nurse practitioners who many times can see patients, you know, can be the primary you know, caretaker in certain times. So, so I would say, yes, see the right clinician at the right time.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Well, Dr. Bhatia, we really appreciate you staying on with us. Stay on for a few minutes. We'll chat right now. So I just wanted to thank everyone for listening. This is another episode of Journey to Private Practice. I'm your host, Omar Khatib, and we'll see you next time. Thanks for listening to this episode of Journey to Private Practice. If you like the show, hey, help other medical practice owners like yourself discover it. Please leave us a 5-star review, say a few nice things, and if anything, send this episode to somebody else, because I don't know about you, but for me, anytime anything good has happened in my life, it's been as a result of other people helping me. So forward this on, pay it forward, and we'll see you next time.